Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by McKay Coppins from The Atlantic. He's got a big cover story out. I it's always a big thrill to have the cover story. I want to show everybody. It's great. My year as a degenerate gambler. That is a dream headline. McKay, I got to say, if I can ever get The Bulwark to let me do this, it would be great. McKay, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. And I agree that there is a romantic thrill to seeing a print cover story that calls you a degenerate. You know, there's really just nothing like it. Nothing. It doesn't compare to being called a degenerate on the internet, you know?
Yeah, that's real degeneracy. If you're on, the only way it could get more degenerate is if it's on the cover of a book. So you turn this into a book and you got a whole thing going. All right. So let's just explain to folks this story, because when I saw you tweeting about it, I was like, this can't possibly be what The Atlantic let him do. But it turns out it was. What was your deal with The Atlantic to explore the vagaries of online and meat space gambling as it spreads through America?
Yeah, so the idea at the beginning was much more normal. It was The Atlantic wanted me to write a big feature about the explosive growth of the sports betting industry and what gambling is doing to America. Because I had a sense that, you know, as much as this is a story about sports, it's also just a story about culture and American life, because gambling has kind of come to permeate every facet of this country and society. But as we were talking through the various ways that I might report out the story, my editor said, you know, I think it would actually be better if you experience the phenomenon firsthand. And I said, I agree, that would be entertaining. But, you know, I'm a Mormon, I don't gamble. It's, you know, kind of part of the religious the religious constraints of being a Latter-day Saint. And he said, no, that's fine. We have this idea. And the idea was, we will give you stake you $10,000, and you can use it to gamble over the course of the NFL season. We'll cover your losses, but in order to try to keep you invested and to kind of simulate the experience of gambling, we'll split the winnings with you 50-50. So you have some reason to really, you know, try, right? And so that was the deal. I spent, the cover says my year as a degenerate gambler. It was really like 5 or 6 months of degeneracy. But I downloaded DraftKings the first day of the NFL season and spent that whole season gambling.
Let's talk about the actual mechanics of this, because you live in a state where do you live? In Virginia, Maryland?
I'm in Virginia. Yep.
Okay. So in Virginia, you can play DraftKings and the other apps, but it's still kind of limited. Like it is not a nationwide phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So what were some of the what did you have to do to get access to all of the wonders of gambling on your phone?
Yeah. So in this kind of new Wild West era of sports betting in America, your experience varies state to state, right? So in Virginia, actually, online sports betting is legal, which is, by the way, the case in most states now. About 40 states have legalized sports betting in some form. And so... in my state, it was relatively easy. I downloaded DraftKings, eventually downloaded FanDuel, a couple other apps as well. Though I noticed that when I traveled from state to state, it changed. My access to it changed, right? In some states, I was locked out of my accounts entirely. In some states, I could only use certain apps. Florida, for example, this is my favorite little tidbit, as part of a compromise between the state of Florida and the Seminole tribe, you are only allowed to use one online sports book. It's Hard Rock Bet, and you're allowed to use it because the servers are located on native lands. So you're still technically only gambling through sure. the tribal land. So anyway, it changes, but I will say it was pretty easy. I downloaded DraftKings 15 minutes before kickoff. of the first game of the NFL season. I think I did some verification of my identity or something. I tapped in my debit card information, deposited $500, and I was off.
It's wild. It's wild how much easier it is now. I remember, look, old person story here, but I remember back in 2000 when the online poker boom was first kind of starting.
Yeah,
it was this weird gray area. Like, nobody was really sure if it was legal, and you had to kind of route your money through. I used some sort of Swiss money routing account system to get them.
I feel like we need to stipulate this whole conversation. How much of a gambler are you, Sonny?
We'll get to this. Don't worry, McKay. We'll get to this. I've got a lot of questions about your adventures with Tom Nichols and Nate Silver. Just to set the stage here, I dabbled with, I played a lot of online poker for very low stakes, and was good enough to like pay for two trips to Las Vegas. That was the height of my online gambling. And I do. I enjoy playing. I enjoy gambling in Las Vegas at table games. I am not a sports gambler for reasons, again, we might discuss here in a minute. We're not here to judge me, McKay. We're here to judge you. You actually had to go to your religious leaders. You had to go to your bishop, right?
My bishop,
and say, hey,
yeah.
what can I do this? Is this okay?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't so much like I didn't want to put him in a position to give me permission because I knew that the church's guidance on gambling is that it's bad for the soul. It fosters greed and, idleness. And, the church's teaching about this is not wholly original, I should say. It's kind of every civilization before us has basically landed at the same place, from Aristotle to St. Augustine to, Warren Buffett, right? But my bishop, I wanted more his guidance, right? His spiritual guidance. And as I explain the experiment to him, I write about this. It's a very awkward conversation where this like look of pastoral concern blooms across his face. And he basically says, look, I understand this is not your money. You're doing it for journalistic purposes. I can grasp the difference between regular gambling and this. At the same time, he said, I have seen enough people whose lives have been kind of wrecked by vice that I want to give you a word of warning. And the last thing he said to me before I left that meeting was, be careful. And it's funny because at the time I almost thought like he was being a little dramatic. And I was like, look, this is like a stunt for a magazine story. It's a journalistic gimmick. It's not going to affect me in any meaningful way. But that ended up proving kind of prophetic.
I want to touch on something that you just said, that every civilization before us has landed in the same place on gambling, which is to limit it pretty strictly, if not outright ban it. And again, I struggle with this because I do have a general libertarian, if people want to do things, that's fine. But I've said this over and over again. The thing I have shifted most on over the last 10 to 15 years is the proliferation of online gambling, which I think is really, questionably dangerous in and of itself. But when combined with the addiction machines we have in our pocket all the time, just potentially civilizationally catastrophic. And that's one of the reasons why we're discussing it on this show today. I know this is Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. This is not strictly speaking about Hollywood, but this is about the culture. This is about how we interact with the culture, and it changed how you watched sports, right? Like watching sports is a big cultural event in this society. It's a big business, and it is fundamentally changing the experience and the action of watching athletic competition, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, if you think about sports as basically one of the last bastions of American monoculture, right? One of the last things that brings people together from all different segments of society, different racial, ethnic, socioeconomic backgrounds. It really matters that gambling has so quickly and so extensively kind of intertwined itself with American sports, right? And there's a reason that the leagues did this. I should say, up until 2018, 2019, the professional sports leagues were vehemently opposed to online gambling or really sports gambling at all. The commissioners had looked at the history. They'd seen the kind of point shaving scandals in college basketball, the rigged World Series of 1919, and basically come to the conclusion that too much sports betting posed an existential risk to the integrity of the game, right? That if fans started to question whether what they were seeing on the court or the field was being manipulated by gambling, they would lose interest. They would, they would tune out. They would turn off the TV. And so that was the calculation they had made for a long time. After the Supreme Court overturned the federal ban on sports betting in 2018, states started to legalize it. And the leagues basically made the calculation that, yes, there was a lot of money to be made in partnering with the sports books. And they do that, right? There's a lot of advertising money, there's data deals. Mm-hmm. But even more than that, they were looking at their own data and they were seeing TV ratings starting to decline for live sports. They were seeing younger fans disengage from sports, right? That younger fans were totally happy to watch Kevin Durant the highlights on TikTok and not actually watch the games themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of realized, oh, gambling is a way that we can get people to re-engage, right? If you have $50 riding on a Spurs game, you're probably more likely to watch from tip off to, you know, the last second of the game because you have money on the line, right? And so they made that decision. But I will say, I don't think that they realized how much it would change the experience of watching it, how much it would kind of atomize fans, and we can talk about that, how much it would foster conspiratorial thinking about how gambling is affecting the games. And I experienced all of this as somebody who is gambling.
There's so many different avenues to jump on here, but let's just go with this one. Is it conspiratorial thinking if every month or so we're seeing a story about players getting busted for, yeah, and not even tanking games, right? And this is, I think, the thing that people don't always appreciate about this, the level of granular betting you can do, like, yes, what will the fifth pitch be in the seventh, mm-hmm, inning, you know? Like, the guys who are throwing balls in the dirt so their buddies can collect $50,000 bets on, yep, DraftKings or whatever, that's real. It's happening. It's happening, mm-hmm, all the time. It has to change. It changes. But again, this changes how people are watching and experiencing the games.
Mm-hmm. No, and that's the thing. Like, the thing about all these revelations that have come out in the last couple years about, these gambling scandals, right? What we don't know is, are these scandals the tip of the iceberg, right? And they're actually just revealing a much more kind of deeply rooted and systemic corruption of these sports. Or are they kind of fluky one-offs or two-offs or three-offs, right? Like, mm-hmm, is it the case that basically this is happening, but it's statistically rare? My point is, it kind of doesn't matter. Because, mm-hmm, as long as you have planted the seed of doubt about how, above board these games are, that it in and of itself poses a risk, right? Like, mm-hmm, I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but I write about it. Huge numbers of sports fans now believe that athletes at least sometimes manipulate their performance for gambling outcomes, right? Like, majorities of fans now believe that. That is a catastrophe for organized sports. If people really internalize this idea that any given game that they're watching could be manipulated by athletes, by referees, by coaches who have figured out how to put money on these games, eventually they're going to lose interest. Right now, I think we're in the stage where it's just a lot of kind of paranoia, right? Like every time a bet doesn't go your way, and this happened to me, you start to wonder, well, did that referee, you know, just make $10,000 on that one call that swung the game? Did some coach have the under on his own team, and that's why he was calling stupid plays at the end, right? Like we're still all watching, but we're wondering about how legitimate it is. My prediction, and this is speculative, is that eventually people, if this continues on the same trajectory, we'll start to think about baseball and basketball and football like they think about professional wrestling, where it's like, oh, it's entertaining, but it's obviously bogus. And that I think that would be a really bad outcome.
Yeah. Speaking of the atomization of all this, one of the things you discuss is in your piece is going to a sports book and like, in theory, it's more communal. There's lots of people there. They're all watching games, but they're all watching different games, and they're all watching those games differently. Like we talk about sports as the last vestige of the monoculture, and that's true to a certain extent. But in this particular arena, it is, if anything, even more nichified than everything else in society.
Because you alluded to this earlier, the way that you bet on games is very different than I think the average person who doesn't gamble understands, right? Like, most people understand that you could bet on a team to win or lose, or you could bet maybe on a point spread. You might understand that, like, you know, the Cowboys to win by 4 points or more, right? But if you open these apps on your phone, like, the opportunities are endless. Like, you can bet, like you said, on every pitch of a baseball game. Like, is the next pitch going to be a ball or a strike? You can bet on individual obscure players on basketball teams to have over or under 4 assists, right? Like, you can bet on anything, which means that when you go to a sportsbook lounge, like, I went one night to, actually, just nearby in Maryland, National Harbor, they have this, the MGM casino, and I went and watched this Chargers game, and I kind of assumed that I would be able to, like, develop a kind of temporary, you know, solidarity with other people who had bought an artificial rooting interest in the game, right? Other people who had bet on the Chargers and I would all kind of, like, band together, and it would be this fun experience, and we'd be high-fiving if they won, whatever. That's not really what it was like. What it was actually like is there's a million screens, there's 6 different games on, you know, the Chargers game, but also a bunch of different random NBA games. Everybody's paying attention to different games, or they're paying attention to the same game, but they're paying attention to the kind of micro bets within the game, right? Like, everybody has their own hyper individualized portfolio of prop bets and parlays that they're rooting for. And it really takes away from the communal experience of, like, just rooting for a team to win or lose.
Yeah. All right. So you mentioned, you know, having familiarity with gambling. Let's go back to the start of this for you, because you are not a gambler. This was not your milieu. When you sat down to try to figure out how to do this, what was the sense? Was it overwhelming? Was it just like, what am I doing?
The very first night, it was partly very stressful because I did not know what I was doing. I remember scrolling through DraftKings and just being like, man, I don't even know what these words mean. Like, what is a alternative spread? What is a same game parlay? What's a profit boost, right? And I basically just punched in a bunch of bets at random. I think I had 5 bets on that first game. And so it was stressful trying to watch the game and toggle back and forth between my 5 different bets and see where I was at. And, you know, the apps often give you live cash out options, which is like, you know, your bet's not going that well. Do you want to cut your losses right now and cash out? And it was like kind of sensory overload. But I also immediately understood why people do this. Like, I was like, oh, this is kind of amazing. Like, I have bought this artificial rooting interest in a game that I would not have otherwise cared about. And it's way more fun, right? Like, I'm locked in a way that I never would have been if I didn't have money on it. And so, as stressful as it was, it also, the kind of appeal of it became visible right away.
Yeah. You, one of the things you write about is, sitting down, or well, I guess probably virtually, but sitting down with Nate Silver and yes. and having him kind of explain to you what you should be doing here. And I get the sense his advice was go get out and bet on something else because sports gambling is for suckers.
Well, so Nate, the reason I went to Nate is obviously he's a stats nerd, and he famously was very good at these proprietary polling models. So I got to know his work in politics, but in sports, the reason I went to him was because I knew he had made hundreds of thousands of dollars gambling. But then when I started to talk to him about it, he was like, yeah, I made all that money playing poker, right? Like he's been in poker tournaments. He's done very well in poker tournaments. He said gambling on sports, and in particular gambling on the NFL, which is what I was mostly betting on, is incredibly difficult to make money on. Like, you know, he said, I remember asking him, if I'm starting with $10,000, how much would I have to win to consider this like a good season, you know? And he kind of almost like laughed at me. He was like, no, you don't understand. If you win one penny, that's better than 98% of sports gamblers. Like, everybody loses money in the long run, right? And there's all these kind of things baked into sports betting that give the house the edge, right? So they charge you upfront 4.5% for every bet that you make, which means that after taxes and after the VIG that they take, you actually have to win like 55% of your bets just to break even. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Another thing is they are constantly shifting the lines throughout the games and trying to entice you to do live betting. But when you watch a game on TV, of course, it's on a 20 to 30 second delay, whereas they have real time data. So you're basically betting against somebody who lives 30 seconds in the future, shifting the line based on things that have happened that you haven't seen yet. All the most popular bets, the parlays and prop bets, are basically suckers bets. Like, it's where they make the vast majority of their profit. Recreational gamblers like me love them because they're fun, but they almost always lose. So there's all these all this advice that he gave me, and basically it boiled down to, if you're going to do this, a sensible, respectable sports bettor would, like, very unemotionally and very rationally comb through you know, all the lines every week, pour over, you know, roster reports and weather updates and all the things that could affect the outcome of a game, and basically make very kind of statistically grounded bets early in the week for reasonable amounts of money. That is not how really anyone gambles on these apps, or at least the vast majority of recreational gamblers don't operate that way. Nate, who told me that he would consider it a win if he broke even for the season, you know, that's how he gambles because he's a statistics wonk, right? Mm-hmm. That's not how the average DraftKings user gambles. And DraftKings knows it, and that's why they're so profitable.
Were you doing any of the daily fantasy stuff, or was it all lines and spreads and everything?
You know, I have my one fantasy league is with a bunch of other former Mormon missionaries that I served with. So we don't have money involved in our league, but no, I didn't do any of the daily fantasy. Do you do, you're a baseball fan, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you do fantasy, and do you involve gambling with it? Because that's a lot of people's gateway into sports betting is through fantasy.
Sure. So I have been in a keeper fantasy baseball league for 20 years now. I think this is actually the 20th season. We bet, it's like $25 or $50 a year into a pot. And then I've never done the daily fantasy, stuff. It very quickly became obvious that that was a sucker's game because there were people, you know, playing enormous numbers of, you know, like the way that breaks, it just didn't work at all. So I have played fantasy sports for 25 years, and this is another kind of interesting way that the culture of sports has changed, right? You know, 15, 20 years ago when everybody started playing fantasy, that immediately created a boost of interest in random games.
Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, I've got Frank Gore as my running back. I care about this San Francisco 49ers game that I never would have watched before. And it does feel like, I mean, look, it's a sliding scale, but I do think that that is basically, you know, kind of fun and okay. And when you start tying your bank account, directly to it through the, again, the machine in your pocket that buzzes and beeps every time you do something good, like it's very dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, this is like the thing about fantasy and gambling is that like, the league's bets on them basically paid off, at least as of now, right? Like, it has engaged a lot of people in sports. It has brought in a lot of money. And, like, it's hard to say that, like, you know, the league's made a bad decision. But I just think that, like, right now we're probably right at the cusp of a kind of a brewing backlash against the way that gambling has permeated the culture, and I wonder if they'll look back at it 10 years from now and realize they made a mistake.
I want to talk about the backlash here, because it is interesting that you know, these apps are just objectively very popular. Lots of people use them. They're making tons of money. The amount of money sloshing around in what I think of as like the sin apps, you know, the gambling apps, but also like OnlyFans and Kalshi and Polymarket, which we'll get to in a minute. Is enormous. There's so much money there. But it does feel like there is a backlash against these sites brewing. The polling shows this, and it does feel like there's a political opening here for somebody to get in to at the very least say, stop with the goddamn ads. Or sorry, apologies. Stop with the ads. Stop with the ads.
So that, yeah, look, so I interviewed this guy, Paul Tonko, who's a Democrat from New York in the House, who has kind of made this his main cause. And it's because he is on the like addiction and recovery caucus. And when he first started seeing the ads for the online sports books, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, he was like kind of shocked. He said, first of all, They reminded him a lot of the cigarette ads of a generation ago, right? Where they're like very glossy, they're very well done, they're slickly made, they're clearly predatory in some way, and they're designed to hook young people and turn them into lifelong customers. That's the whole idea, right? They target 21-year-olds. I mean, frankly, you could argue that they're really targeting like 15, 16-year-olds because they're on TV all the time. And so his first piece of legislation was just targeting the ads. Let's regulate the advertising around this industry, right? And I mean, it would seem that that is commonsensical, right? Like, I cannot watch a game with my 10-year-old son without him being blasted with like 15 neon-soaked, star-studded ads for online casinos, you know, with all of his favorite players, Tom Brady, like Kevin Garnett, Wayne Gretzky, are all there hawking these ads or these apps, right? As if they don't have enough money already. So that to me is that's an obvious place to start. That might actually be one of the hardest things to regulate, though, because that's where all the money is coming from. You know, the reason the leagues like this, and the reason that their media deals are worth so much, and the reason that basically all of sports media now is subsidized by sports betting industry, is because of the ads. So that's one place to start. But there are a bunch of other small things. I mean, you could create a national self-exclusion list, right? Making it easier for people wherever they live to sign a list that effectively cuts them off from gambling, saying, you know, that I have a problem. I don't want sportsbooks to take my action anymore. Those exist on a state-to-state basis, but you could create a national one. You could have laws that basically say that when you sign up for FanDuel or DraftKings, they require you to tell them how much money you're willing to lose each month. And so once you hit that limit, let's say I don't want to lose more than $200 a month. Once you hit that limit, the app locks you out, right? There are all kinds of things that you could do like this. And I actually think we are just beginning to see glimmers of kind of a bipartisan consensus forming about this. Like, there are a couple pieces of of bipartisan legislation that have come out recently, mostly targeting the prediction markets. But I think that it'll come for the sports betting apps eventually too. But the problem they're up against, and you got at it, Sonny, is like, it's really hard for the government to take away things that people like, you know, like that my 13-year-old daughter right now is studying prohibition in her social studies class. And she just wrote a paper on prohibition and I was helping her with it. And you kind of realize like that we all learned this lesson studying the prohibition era that like, you know, a maximalist crackdown on a vice that, yes, does actually have a lot of social ills associated with it, but also a lot of people like, and many people can do engage in responsibly, like that probably isn't the way to do it. So I just believe that as a country, we are smart enough to realize that we can, without criminalizing a vice, regulate it and maintain a healthy social stigma around it, which I also think we've lost and probably would be good to get back a little bit.
Well, the social stigma part is interesting too, because it does, there is certainly in, I would say, male dominated spaces, which I spend most of my time in, frankly, there's no stigma about gambling. Like one of the really interesting things, I don't know, you know, do you know the writer Chuck Klosterman?
Yeah, of course.
So like Klosterman, has a new book out about football and he talks about gambling in it a little bit. And it was really interesting talking to him. I had him on the show, because he is not a gambler, but he actually really likes the gambling apps because it gives him things to talk about, which is like the most Klosterman answer I can think of. But like it was really interesting because it does, like, it creates lots of different avenues of discussion, lots of different avenues of interest. Even if you don't have a vested financial interest, you go to your friend, your kid's friend's dad, and you're like, hey, so, you know, who you got in this Patriots game? You know, what do you think is line? This line, 4.5 points? That's crazy.
And that's the thing. It's a much broader variety of things to start sports debates about, right? Because, like, the fun of sports in male-dominated places, especially, like, with other men, is to kind of argue about sports. And rather than just saying, are the Seahawks better than the Patriots, which, like, that argument can kind of exhaust itself, it's, are the Seahawks 3.5 points better than the Patriots in the Super Bowl? I don't know. Like, I would say it should be 2 points. And, you know, like, there's a lot. Or is Drake May, like, the over-under for 200 yards? I mean, is that really right? And you can argue about that. I kind of get that. Like, there is, and there's a reason that, like, every sports podcast that you listen to now revolves around gambling. It kind of sets the table for interesting conversations and segments in a way that didn't exist when nobody knew about gambling.
Well, and it is the proliferation of gambling ads into podcasts is really interesting to me. And I don't think we have any gambling sponsors. So I don't think maybe in some of the programmed ads through Audio Boom, I don't know. But the simple act of having these people who are like in your ear all the time talking to you, who you think of kind of parasocially as your friend, are talking about gambling all the time.
Is such an
impetus to like start doing it yourself. That it is hard to resist. I get why it's hard to resist. I get why people are into it.
And again, it goes back to like, it chips away at the social stigma that used to exist around gambling, right? Like my favorite data point in this, just in the, you know, a little peek behind the scenes at the Atlantic, when we were thinking of cover lines for this story, you know, the editor suggested my year as a degenerate gambler. And I noted, and one of the other editors working on the story noted that there are some in the addiction recovery community who object to the use of degenerate gambler because it's offensive. And we were like, you know, if we put that on the cover, it might, you know, offend some people. We decided it was, you know, the editors decided, yeah, it's okay. Like, we'll live with that. What's funny is once it was published, there were a lot of people offended, but it was not people in the gambling addiction recovery. It was people who proudly wear the badge of degenerate gambler and were like arguing that it was stolen valor for me to call myself a degenerate gambler because I was gambling with my employer's money. They're like, you're not even close to degenerate enough to call yourself a degenerate gambler. So my point is like, that it just shows how far the kind of Overton window has shifted on this thing, you know.
That's very funny and also not surprising. That's a very unsurprising thing to have happen. Let's talk a little bit about Kalshi and Polymarket, because these two sites do kind of introduce an interesting wrinkle into all this, which is that they have functionally nationalized sports gambling by calling them prediction markets, and they also do another thing which I think is probably better than what the gambling apps do, which is that you are actually competing against other users. You're not competing against the house, and this has always been my thing, and I think this is kind of Nate Silver kind of hints at this in your piece a little bit as well, which is that like when you go up against the house, you are always going to have a losing edge. The house doesn't put bets out there that they don't think they're going to win, because that's how they make money. When you're going against other people, you're competing against other users. It's not
other dummies.
I was trying to put it more nicely than that, but yes, you're competing against people as stupid as you. And that is different. It's why I like poker instead of slots or even blackjack. Like this is I prefer poker for precisely this reason. That said, I do think it feels like the Kalshi Polymarket backlash is coming faster than the online gambling backlash. Am I wrong there?
I totally agree. I would go even a step further. I think the backlash against the prediction markets is going to be eventually felt by the rest of the sports betting industry. And I think probably a lot of people at like DraftKings are probably very angry at the prediction markets because they are basically courting this backlash. But I would say the backlash is largely not about sports with the prediction markets. The reason people are getting so upset about these markets and the reason that politicians now are, you know, introducing bills to rein them in is because you can gamble on Iranian missile strikes and, how many deportations will take place in America and whether Gaza will experience a famine. And like you can bet on preposterous dystopian life and death things that like, of course, nobody should be able to gamble on. Right. Like, I think we all sort of understand that like this is a Black Mirror episode when we're gambling on like which, you know, part of Tehran is going to be bombed on what day, you know? And so I think that's the initial kind of gateway into the backlash. But I think eventually once politicians start, you know, legislating about this stuff and regulating it, there will be other areas of regulation. And then we'll get into the questions about like, well, how much do we want this gambling industry to just kind of like operate without any real oversight? And I don't know where we'll land on it. Like I said, it's hard to take away things that people like. At the same time, I do think that the kind of socially disastrous effects of where we are starting to be felt on the ground. And while true degenerate gamblers might resist the regulation, a lot of their loved ones, a lot of wives and mothers, for example, are going to welcome their senator passing a bill that cracks down on sports betting.
Yeah. These were, of course, cores of the temperance groups and
to go back to prohibition. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think prohibition is the answer here. Inside me, there is this kind of eternal struggle of freedom. People should be allowed to ruin their lives. But also, man, let's talk about something happier. Tom Nichols. You got to hang out with Tom Nichols on the Love Tom. We've had him on our various podcasts a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. Love Tom, he's great. But he showed you the real Vegas. He showed you how to actually have fun while gambling.
So the backstory here is that I don't know when it was, sometime last year, maybe the year before, Jeffrey Goldberg editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, was for some reason at some event in Las Vegas with Tom. And Jeff expressed, I think, the common attitude that a lot of East Coast media elites have about Las Vegas. Just kidding, Jeff. Which is like, I kind of hate Vegas. And Tom was like, oh, I love it here. I come here several times a year. And so he showed Jeff around, and Jeff was saying, you really need to go experience Vegas with Tom Nichols, like, for this story, right? And part of it is because, you know, Tom argues that that gambling in Vegas is almost wholesome compared to the sports betting apps, right? Mm-hmm. The sports betting apps are like isolating and addictive, and like everything else on our phone kind of take us away from our regular lives and interactions with other humans. And I think that's true. You know, Tom was like, look, let's go to all my favorite casinos, the Strat and the Golden Nugget and the ones that are off the strip where that have slightly better odds, lower table minimums, you know, and where you'll just meet real people, as salt of the earth Vegas people, right? And so, and we sat down at all these blackjack tables, and he was kind of right. I mean, you like would meet people from all across the country, from different, you know, backgrounds, and you start to, you know, I struck up a conversation with these two ladies in their 60s who told me about, you know, they're chain smoking and razzing me for not hitting on 16 and telling me about their, you know, one of their weddings where everyone wore Packers jerseys. And like, it was a real, like it was almost Rockwellian compared to like sitting on DraftKings at 1 a.m. in my bed. Right. And so, you know, like his argument is that Vegas gets a bad rap and for, you know, all the predictable reasons. And a lot of it is legitimate, like, you know, seeing senior citizens kind of like pump their money into slot machines while sucking on oxygen. Like that's a depressing sight, you know, but there's also a lot of Vegas that's not like that. A lot of casinos, especially the old school casinos, are just, you know, it's just like a bunch of people hanging out, getting to know each other, gradually losing money together, but you're kind of okay with it, right?
Yeah.
But let me say the other thing, because this connects to what we were just talking about. Part of the reason I came to appreciate Vegas on that trip was that, like, we were talking about the need for friction in gambling, right? Like, I actually appreciate Vegas and places like it as sort of containment zones for gambling and for vice in general, right? Like, I'm basically with you that I think in like a liberal democratic society, you can't, you know, we don't live in a theocracy. As much as I think everyone would be better off if gambling didn't exist, I also don't think you can just like ban it because I think it's bad, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I do think you can do is basically say, okay, if you want to engage in this vice, you have to put a little work in. You have to go to certain physical locations. You need to plan. And you need to go ideally to like places like Vegas, these like remote desert cities that make you feel a little bad about yourself. And like after you're there for a few days, you're like, get me out of here, right? I think that we should make gambling a thing that you have to work to get to, not something that is omnipresent in your life because it's just in your pocket all day long.
I think that is basically where I come down as well. I have a general rule: 2 days in Vegas is more than enough. You know, Friday, Saturday, out by Sunday, you're good. Yep. That's a fine time. And like you say, there's something to be said. There's also something to be said for gambling with cash. Now you exchange for checks, and that's one of the ways the casino. But like having to go and put actual cash money that's on the true. Table, I think like really changes how you feel about things, as opposed to just like scrolling a dial on your gambling app and be like $500. Yeah, there we go. Sure, that's real money.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point. Like being at the blackjack table with Tom, like I had this wad of cash and I felt it getting thinner. You know, like you physically feel it, and then it's exchanged for chips, and then I see my pile of chips shrinking, and I'm like, okay, now is a good moment to pause and go for a walk. I'm gonna, you know, color out and walk around the floor for a minute. Like the apps make it so easy to just reload, right? Like it's like it'll you literally put a bet in and it'll say you don't have enough money in your account. Do you want to reload? and you just swipe to the right and you're reloaded. You have the money in there now. And that, like, to your point, like, that just, you know, that that's not leading anywhere good, right?
Well, this was always my experience with poker. And it's one reason why I stayed away. I tended to stay away from cash games, and I played these small one table tournaments, the sit and goes, because, like, you put in $5 or $10. That's it. The, like, once the tournament is over, you know, there's the cash out. With the cash games, you very quickly get into a situation. If you get it, getting on Tilt online is a very dangerous thing. You don't want that. All right. Let's and you experienced a little bit. I don't want to spoil the end of your piece. You experienced a little bit of this in your in your journey. All right. One last Tom Nichols question, because, again, we love Tom Nichols here. What is his game? What was he sitting you down to play? And at what stakes was he playing? Was he big spender? Were you sitting it down at the $100 tables?
I wonder if he was performing for me, because he was like a model of, like, moderate, sensible betting. He's a blackjack player. Blackjack is his main game. He said he's played poker, but he doesn't like the kind of the quantification of poker. You know, he said, like, you sit down now at a poker table in Vegas and it's a bunch of guys who are, like, have their headphones in, and they're just, like, you know, and so he doesn't love that. It's also why he doesn't do sports betting. It's just, like, you know, the quants have taken over, and he finds that unappealing. Blackjack is his game. I would say he was playing, like, probably, like, $20 hands, $40 hands. Maybe he was playing $50 hands at a certain point. He did well. I think he came out ahead in blackjack, but he also showed me around the casinos and showing me the other games. And I literally had a little notebook where I was writing down, you know, Professor Nichols' wisdom. And one of the things he said was, don't bother with roulette. That's a Euro trash game. You know, craps is fun, but complicated. But the casino will teach you, which I think is hilarious. There's these little things at the table that are like, come at 11 a.m. every day and we'll teach you how to play craps.
That should be the biggest red flag of all. There should just be a giant red flag over the table. If the casino's like, hey, we will teach you how to play this game with us.
Yeah, it's not out of generosity of spirit that they want to teach you how to play craps. And he did actually play the slots for a little bit, but he's generally, like, temperamentally averse to slot machines. And because his feeling is, if you're going to go to Vegas, don't sit in front of a computer. That's his whole thing. Like, you can gamble on your phone now. Like, if you're going to go to Vegas, go gamble with other people. That's the whole point.
Yeah, I should note for the record that craps has the best odds for the player, I believe, if you play it right. If you do it right, that's the best. But because I don't want the gamblers to yell at me about slagging craps, but it is not a game for me. It's too complicated. There's too many different things going on. Okay. That's about it. That was everything I wanted. Oh, you know what? Actually, I take it back. There was one other thing you had mentioned. The exclusion lists. You had mentioned exclusion lists and how there's state by state now. There could be a national one, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that jumped out at me in your piece was the incredibly predatory thing that happened that you heard about happening when discussing this. These aren't a panacea.
No, I talked to Craig Carton, who's, like, a popular sports talk radio host in New York City, a recovering gambling addict who now works with other gambling addicts. And he said that when he signed the self-exclusion list in New Jersey, where he lives, you know, it worked. The online apps locked him out. But a couple weeks later, he got a letter from a casino in Atlantic City, a brick and mortar casino, that said, hey, we saw that you recently self-excluded from online gambling. We want you to know we would welcome your business anytime. Please come and play with us. Which, like, if you want one anecdote that illustrates how predatory the gambling industry is, I mean, you can't get much better than that.
Again, this really... A lot of feelings inside me and tension at the moment, which is always fun. All right, that was everything I wanted to ask McKay. Again, you should read the piece, My Year as a Degenerate Gambler. I'll link to it in this newsletter. You should, of course, subscribe to The Atlantic, great magazine. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. If you think there's anything folks should know about your piece, about the state of gambling in America, the culture. What's
you know, so I do think, just going back to the prediction markets, a lot of the attention has been on the apparent corruption of like military and government insiders cashing in on their inside knowledge, right? People who clearly seem to have knowledge of impending military operations in Venezuela or Iran, making hundreds of thousands of dollars based on that knowledge. And that is bad. I agree. Like, obviously outrageous. I think the real concern is that people in the military or the government will start manipulating public events to cash in on polymarket bets, right? Like, choosing their, you know, missile strike locations or the dates of certain operations to maximize their profits on these prediction markets. And the truth is, that could be happening already and we don't even know, right? So that, again, is where I come back to, like, the prediction markets are fine. I think they're actually kind of useful tools in, you know, politics and you know, seeing where the trend lines are heading on things like the Oscars race or whatever. But, like, I just really don't think that it is in anyone's interest to allow people to gamble on life and death military operations. And so hopefully that, if nothing else, we can figure out a way to regulate that as a country.
Yeah. Yeah. McKay Coppins, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, honey.
It was it's a very fun piece. My Year as a Degenerate Gambler in The Atlantic. I will link to it. You should read it. But it's a lot of fun. Anyway, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.